sisters and soldiers. Don't miss the warm, the smile. Ashtrays and countertops reflecting. Have a friend for a while. Planes meet the sky. Girls say goodbye. Couches and magazines left for those who cannot. Second cup free. Joanna's traveling in silver. Joanna said goodbye to me. Said goodbye. Couches and magazines left for those who cannot fly.
We finished today's program with a 70s era, not sure exactly the year, band led by Paul Giovanni, who you perhaps know best as the composer and performer of all the music to The Wicker Man soundtrack from 1973. Paul Giovanni's band here on Atlantic Records, Sideshow, and a self-titled LP. I wonder if the label is flipped. I think we heard the song Cold Coffee, but it says we heard Joanna. Sorry. Bodenstandig 2000 with a great sample of Vicky Leandro singing Tale of Your Farnachlotsch on their track Deck Jigelkrauer. We took it from our very own excellent DJ Monica's 2012 WFMU Marathon Premium. It's called Celebrity Headphones. It was preceded by music from Windbreaker, a split 12-inch single with Gel Set out of Chicago. A track we heard called Meet Me on the Autostrada. 1990 music out of Hungary from Vagtazo Halott Kemek before that. record called Avilagostan Kirgrastasa, better known as Jumping Out the World / Instinct. Alternative Tentacles reissued some of their stuff. Great Hungarian band. Indulok was the name of the track we heard. I'm Going to Do It. Faden Sonnen before that, from two CD set of his live guitar improvisations called PD2. We heard the track Brutal Minimal. And we opened up the set, as promised hours ago, with music from Hawkwind, performing live in 1972 in Cambridge, UK. Leave No Star Unturned, the name of the LP that collects this, and that very, very abruptly just ends in the middle of You Shouldn't Do That. Whoops, sorry. Marcello Giordani behind us now, the Song of God from Respect Yourself. And that, my friends, is the end of the program. We say goodbye, fare you well, see you next week. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is up next with his interview with Richard Hell on the book tour. Thanks for listening, everybody. It's Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online, WFMU.org. See you next week. Bye-bye. We'll be right back. You're listening to WFMU. This is Too Much Information. My name is Benjamin Walker, and this week on the program, we're hanging out with Richard Hell, who has just published his autobiography called I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. Welcome to WFMU, Richard.
Hi, Benjamin.
Thanks for doing this. I have to say, I'm really glad you said no to coming to WFMU, because I get to see your place here in the East Village. And being a book person, it's always great to be in a room overflowing with books. Do you have your shelf that, like, is if there's a fire, that the ones that you're going to grab first, like, prepared? Someone told me I had to do that the other day and came over and showed me.
Yeah, that's occurred to me, but I don't want to go there even mentally.
You say, all right. Well, I did it the other day.
But you know, I do have my sort of rarer and most treasured books kind of cordoned off.
So, oh, yeah.
I mean, like, in that cabinet behind you, is book, like, books that are my special sort of, you know, objects of collection.
And personal value.
And up there, too. So I know where the ones are that are my fetish.
So you have gone there a bit. You didn't pull out the
actual
shelf.
It wasn't about fire. It was just, you know, I mean, the shelves are organized.
Yeah.
They're mostly alphabetical, but then also, but I mean, they're divided, you know, into sections: poetry, fiction, nonfiction,
photography,
and then alphabetical within that. But then the biggest section is the ones yet to be filed, of course.
I do see a lot of photography books, though.
Photography?
Yeah,
there's a fair number.
Yeah. You've lived in the same apartment since the early 70s. And I was really curious about this. Do you have any other friends or associates with similar situations that have been in the same residence here in New York City for decades?
Uh-huh.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay, because I moved to New York about 7 years ago, and I've been in one place, and it seems...
Well, you know, a fair number of the people who I knew back in those days have kept their apartments, because why would they move when they were rent stabilized and the rent was so low and goes up so gradually, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a few.
I ended up in one of those, and I guess that's, you know, why I've stayed too, but it seems that my experience is very different than a lot of my friends who are moving like almost every 2 years.
Yeah,
and it seems that I've been curious about if you've ever thought about what that's done for your sense of the city and your sense of yourself being so stationary in one place.
Well, you know, up until I found this apartment, I moved every 6 months or 18 months. I mean, I would only stay in a place as long as I could sort of scam, you know what I mean? Because I was made so little money that I'd always hit the rough patch where I wouldn't be able to pay rent, and then you just stretch it out for 2 months before they can legally evict you, and then you go find another place. But when I found this one, I knew I'd hit pay dirt. But I also was really lucky because I was still pretty much of a mess. But I had landlords that were even more of a mess than me. They had Alzheimer's or something, and they would just neglect to collect rent.
Really?
So I would go for months just not having to pay. And then they would just get kind of bewildered when it hit them that the rent was due. And they couldn't figure out. It's kind of a set of circumstances that allowed me to keep this place as long as I have.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the perfect place for you. But
I recommend that to everybody. search for
that's the best kind
very
of
old landlords.
It seems that, you know, you show up in New York on page 50 and the beginning of chapter 6. And New York is one of the main characters in this book. And I'm really, you know, the sense of the city that you had then when you moved here. You know, I want to hear about, like, what your cultural landmarks and people were when, you know, you decided to come here as a young man.
Well, I had a really diluted idea of what New York was like, because my only exposure to it had been because my grandmother lived here.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't born here. She didn't grow up here, but she moved here later in her life. But it was when I was still a kid.
Uh-huh.
And she lived in the West Village, and in this beautiful old little complex of apartment buildings with a courtyard that was a kind of garden, but all really humble, but at the same time gorgeous. And the West Village is like that too. It was more so then, but it's now more glitzy. But at that time, it was just this, you know, isolated enclave of tree-lined old townhouses and tenements, and it was really intimate and pretty. And the only, that's all I'd seen of New York.
Yeah. Sounds
when
very
I came to New York, I thought the whole city was like that. 14th Street was a shock.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's true that I didn't really quite know what I was getting into.
Really?
I was looking for excitement, and I found excitement. But I did have this kind of misconception of what New York was like. I mean, sure, you had skyscrapers in view and everything, but I thought the whole style of life was the way it was in the old-time Greenwich Village, because that's all I'd seen as a kid.
Which sounds very respectable. I mean, but at the same time, there were artists and musicians living around.
Yeah, well, that was
grandmother.
Part of it too. You know, my grandma was real sophisticated. You know, she
so it wasn't just
she was
and
like
tree lines.
And you know, she had wonderful books and art on the walls. You know, nothing fancy. You know, like prints that you could buy at a museum or something like that. But no, sure, I was totally aware that the West Village had this history of bohemia, and that was part of what was nice about it.
It seems that a lot of people come here with their own delusions of New York, though. I mean, I read Luc Sant's book, Low Life, and then Please Kill Me when I was 22. So I had this very distinct, very exciting version of New York that I was like, oh, man, why can't I live there? I'm stuck in Boston. This is terrible. So I don't know. It still seems that...
What? You want the New York of Please Kill Me and Low Life? You can find that. There's still slums.
I guess, you know, in the parts that it maps out, they're very different.
You can go get knives. You can go get stabbed if you really want.
Well, I haven't really seen that outside. All I see are signs like, you know, hand-brined pickles or, you know, pole-caught tuna sandwiches. Yeah. But that's what it seems more around here. But, you know, my friend Pike Malinowski, a fellow radio producer and poet, did this East Village Poetry Rock that you are featured in. This is an MP3 people that can download and then put on their device and walk around the East Village and learn about the East Village poetry scene of the 60s and 70s. You're featured in it in as well. And I'm wondering, did you talk about in the book immersing yourself in this world of poets, but did you have that before you got here, or was all that you soaked up once you arrived?
Excuse me. I don't think I talked about in the book about immersing myself in the world of poets. I mean,
maybe immersing is a strong word, but
I basically was kind of I was kind of put off by the worlds of poets, not out of any kind of disrespect or anything, but just because I was too proud. I didn't want to like apply for membership in some pre-existing society. I started a magazine. I didn't go immerse myself in a world of poets.
Yeah,
I came here to write. It didn't
substitute.
Have to do with any kind of school or existing, movement or community or group.
Substitute the word poetry instead of poets. You talk about reading poetry.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Okay,
yeah.
Then that's what I meant. That's more where I went. Did you have a sense, did you get that sense of the poetry before, did you have that before you came here, or was that something you really started to find more?
My interest in poetry?
No, some of the magazines, the self-published books that you talk about reading and collecting, you know, early on.
No, I wasn't aware of them until I came to New York, where they were being produced. Yeah. You know, because they didn't really travel.
Of course,
and it was a really local thing.
Yeah, but you did have an interest.
But
in
there
poetry.
Was there was a lot of activity in the Lower East Side, publishing Mimeo magazines, and that was inspiring. really inspiring.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this whole attitude towards your work that you didn't apply to the established fortress of existing respectable poets. No, you just had an idea for a book of poetry, typed it up on Mimeo stencils and ran it off, and the next day you had a book. And and those books were also gorgeous. I mean, people think of Mimeos as being degraded or, you know, like second rate or, and you know, inferior and materially, but they're not. That not it really evolved. It's especially in that time and place in the Lower East Side in the late 60s.
Yeah.
Some of the most beautiful books I know were produced on Mimeo machines with drawings in them and carefully designed. And so, yeah, that was really inspiring that you could just take it into your own hands.
Yeah.
It wasn't a matter of looking for acceptance by these straight-laced conservative academic poets who were the people in the university poetry magazines and the established poetry magazines, but just doing it yourself.
Yeah. But you talk about this pride you had of not wanting to apply to this school. Is that because, you know, you just pushed back a bit when I said poets instead of poetry, but it seems that, you know,
I've seen that in a couple of reviews too, where they say I came to New York and joined up with the poetry scene.
Yeah.
That's completely the reverse of what.
Sure, but I would take it even further. It seems that you have a hesitation about even calling yourself a poet sometimes. Like, you pushed back in some reviews about that.
Well, I'm not. I mean, I maybe write two poems a year. And I apply myself a lot harder to a lot of other kinds of work.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's not really accurate to call me a poet. Though, you know, at the same time, I take it as a compliment. If it's applied by the right person, because, you know, I do have my values in writing, I think of as being kind of the values of a poet, but I'm not actively a poet. I don't publish books of poetry. I mean, if I were to do a collected poems, I mean, everything that I'd want to, present as representing whatever I'd done in poetry, it would probably be like 50 pages out of, you know, out of a whole lifetime.
Yeah, but
I'm not really a poet.
Sure, but at this period we're talking about with the magazines, you were making one yourself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it seemed, there's a line when you talk about rejecting a poem of Allen Ginsberg's, I think you say, we had no idea what we were doing.
Yeah, it was just because it was a really obnoxious thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not because I'm an admirer of Ginsberg's, especially, and because he didn't really have much of an influence or effect on me. He wasn't one of the. It was from a different stream of what interested me, but it was really obnoxious to write him and ask for a poem and then reject it.
It's very funny too. I mean, there's the book is very funny and it's very beautifully written. But I have to say there are some, you know, subtle moments of humor, and that is one. I laughed out loud a lot. But, you know, talking about making these magazines and books, you know, one of your earliest collaborations with Tom Verlaine is a collaboration on a book that you called Teresa Stern.
No, called Wanna Go Out.
Wanna Go Out, sorry.
That's Teresa Stern is the name
of
the author.
Yes, okay. Yeah. So it's called Wanna Go Out. Can you talk about that collaboration?
Well, that was kind of the last major thing I did in poetry before I switched entirely to music. And it did feel like a sort of culmination and kind of liberation for me because... it was really interesting to see what it was like to write collaborations. I mean, there have been other people's collaborations that I liked, and it had always intrigued me, that idea of doing something as thought of as being as personal as a poem, collaboratively. And we just sort of developed this like recreation of handing a typewriter back and forth, and taking turns writing a few lines. And it's funny. It is, you know, it's like playing. I don't know what to compare it to exactly. It's like a, you know, it's like playing tennis or something, but with the idea of creating a beautiful game instead of winning. Though there was, you know, part of the fun of it was of undermining what the other guy had just said, you know,
what
at times.
What does that mean?
But, well, you know, there's lots of ways of doing that. You know, they say something flowery and you turn it into, you know, with the next line, you put it in a different light. But anyway, so I started seeing that the stuff that we'd write, we had a kind of eccentric private world going anyway, where we were just goofing all the time. Yeah. The poems that we were doing were very, turned out, it was obvious to be really different from what we each wrote separately. And but not only that, they had a certain consistency to them. They did seem to have, be a kind of third consciousness going on. And so I got the idea of imagining a person who was the author of these poems we were doing. And I invented it was Tom's idea to make her a woman when I but I thought that was brilliant. And then I made up a biography for her. And at that time, as you mentioned, I was publishing books myself, you know, in various ways. I had a little printing press, but this one wasn't done on the printing press. It was done at some kind of nonprofit place that would that made themselves available to poets. Basically, after the first few poems were being written, with both of us aware that we were going to be presenting them as the work of this invented third person, and I published the book, "Wanna Go Out" by Teresa Stern, in an edition of 500. And you know, there's no mention in the book that it's anything other than the work of this writer, Teresa Stern. And there's a author's photo of her that I made by having a friend come over and put us in makeup and wig and take a picture of each of us in, you know, the same position in the frame. And then I superimposed them to get a picture of her.
Love that.
So that's what that is.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, it was one of your earliest collaborations and you were very excited by the idea. But in the book you talk about there, you mentioned the word undermining, but there was some difficulties too. And I'm really curious what you made of these difficulties then. I mean, you're really close. You're super, super close friends. And yet there's something that, you know, that we see later on when you start working together musically that seems to be there from day one when you're working together on these poems. Sort of difficult.
You're talking about like the friction between me and Berlin.
Yeah.
What
did you think of it
was
then?
I think it's, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem unnatural to me. You know, I mean, it's not like anything dramatic. It's just, you know, it was in that period in life when you have best friends. And when you're both kind of have like a strong drive to achieve something in this weird realm of art that we both did, there's, you know, that's very that's. You know, that's a very solitary kind of pursuit, really. There's bound to, but you know, we were linked by this common drive and by respect for each other's sort of the way our minds are put together. But then there are all kinds of personal ways in which we were different. And so that created the friction here and there. And, you know, I think it's a really common story. I mean, if you look at, I mean, almost always artists as young people are sort of cluster in groups.
Yeah.
That have, you know, that usually basically has to do with offering an alternative to what had been going on immediately before them, overturning the, you know, what was generally accepted at that moment. And so they have a lot in common there in their aims and in their work for a few years. And then, you know, as they mature, they go separate ways.
Sure.
It's like, whether you're talking about the Cubists or, you know, rockabilly or, it's really a natural common thing.
Oh, absolutely. The friction that comes out of collaboration between close people is, you know, probably throughout human
history. I'm not talking about friction between close people. Now we've moved on to talking about how, you know, you have a lot in common for a few short years, and you have a sort of shared aims. But then as you mature, the differences in you become more...
Yeah.
Pronounced, and you diverge. You know, it's like
sure, but
really
that,
like a normal pattern.
Even backing up before artistic differences, there's a friendship here. I mean, what's interesting about you and Tom is that you meet when you're in high school, and you know this friendship. There's an adventure that you go on, running away to Florida, where it ends with a field on fire. I don't know. There just seems to be before artistic aims a friendship.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I guess for me, one of the questions in the book is how could things go so wrong for people that are this close, that have such an awesome bond of friendship?
I don't think it's surprising at all. I think it happens all the time.
Yeah.
Just like I was saying.
All right. So when you set out to write this book, did you have a sense of what you wanted to get out of dredging some of this old stuff up, especially when it comes to Tom?
No. I mean, it wasn't about dredging old stuff up in some way that was like painful or traumatic. It was I was writing the story of my life, and I was basically just looking at myself as a specimen because that was my aim to analyze the specimen. So I just put myself back in you know, the sequence of events as they took place from when I was a child up until the book ends, and looked at what happened and tried my best to describe it accurately.
That story when you guys went on that adventure, what was the plan with that when you were going towards Florida?
This is all right.
All right. You're wanting me to
analyze every page of the book.
No, I'm not. We can move on. It's just like, you know what it is? It's just that end of the book. When we end with the book, you end with an encounter with you and Tom. I mean, that's actually the last scene in the book. And can we talk about that then? Like that scene, that encounter. It actually.
You want to move to the end of the book now?
No, I'm moving away from Tom because it seems like you don't want to talk.
You're moving
just to end
Tom.
With Tom and then move on to something else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so no, this is our Tom wrap up.
Okay.
Yeah.
To me, it wasn't just we were talking about Tom. It was I guess it was partly because you did skip the whole childhood stuff. And just
no, we're coming
right
back
to
that. I'm totally coming back to that.
Oh, jeez. Okay, whatever. All right. So, there's an epilogue in the book about me running into Verlaine in the present. It happened in 2011 when I was ending the book. When I was finishing writing the book, that's basically when I finished writing the book. I mean, I knew the ending was kind of abrupt, the way the way I'd left it, you know, stopping in 1984, you know, when I left music basically and stopped using drugs. And I knew it needed something to sort of tie it up, you know, to just put a cap on it. And but I didn't know what to do. And then I had this experience where I ran into Berlin. A lot of the way that worked for me, I mean, it wasn't even about Tom. It was about, and, you know, I think nobody's looked at it this way. Everybody always looks at it as if, oh, Tom was so central to the book, even though he's not, you know, he plays a relatively small role. You know, in a 300-page book, it's maybe 30 pages where there's any talk of Tom. But for me, I think a lot of what made that epilogue appropriate for my purposes, right, wasn't that I was running into Tom. It was that it was a demonstration that everything in the book is provisional. Hmm. I mean, because basically what that last moment did, the epilogue, what I added was reveal that despite what it might have looked like in all the preceding pages where the subject is touched on at all, my friendship and relationship with this guy, in fact, you know, which seemed so fraught and difficult, in fact, it wasn't. It was just, it was actually positive and almost transcendent, you know. I mean, so it was basically throwing in doubt everything I'd said in the whole book. Huh. It was about how, you know, anything you say, you can say the opposite just as easily.
Huh. Many books like this written from someone who was there in a particular point in time are about setting the record straight or taking credit. It seems like there's very little of that, that like you can, it doesn't seem like that was your intention. I mean, like maybe two or three.
Well, it's really
items.
Funny because, you know, I see in people's reactions to the book when I read reviews and et cetera, you get wildly differing attitudes towards that. I mean, some people describe the book as being completely about claiming credit for and for settling scores. And then other people like you say the thing that surprises them about the book is that it doesn't do that. For me, all I can say is that I was just trying to describe what things were like as they happened. Yeah. You know, if I'm saying that this morning I got up and did this, yeah, okay, I'm taking credit for this morning I got up and did this. But the fact is it happened. That morning I got up and I did that.
Yeah. So you're listening to Too Much Information on WFMU. My name is Benjamin Walker. Our guest today is Richard Hell, and we're talking about his new book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. You know, I want to come to punk rock music, actually. You know, there are philosophy books, PhD theses, histories all written on the meaning of punk, where it comes from, what it's all about. But there's a line in this book that I think is probably one of my favorite descriptions of music I've read. You say that rock and roll is the only art form at which teenagers are not only capable of excelling, but that actually requires that one be a teenager, more or less, to practice it at all. This is the way that punk uniquely embodies rock and roll. It explicitly asserts and demonstrates that the music is not about virtuosity. Rock and roll is about natural grace, about style and instinct, and the inherent physical beauty of youth. I really love that passage, and I think it's the acknowledgement of the requirement of youth. I don't know if anyone's ever gone that strong, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't know. To me, it just seems self-evident, though, of course, it's also loose. I mean, as a few people have pointed out, and then I was well aware when I wrote that, my first album came out when I was 27. Mm. I was a very immature 27.
Yeah, it seems you were still young. I think we can call the Richard Hell of that record young. But you know what I'm getting at. I mean, there are lots of people that try.
But I mean, the point of that passage is that it's about. I mean, it's the difference between. It's just contrasting this. That I mean, we all know that it's the art form of teenagers. I mean, that's obvious. And what does that mean? It means that you haven't gotten really good at anything, because getting really good at something takes a lot of practice and a certain kind of maturity and level of discrimination. But that's not what rock and roll is about. It's about what you can do without being skilled.
Yeah.
It's about the things that I state in that.
Yeah, sense. I guess it's sort of the DIY aspect that most people gravitate towards. I feel that they don't connect it to youth in the way that you did. There's something about like anyone can do it.
Well, but I mean, that was about rock and roll in general. That wasn't about punk specifically. There's other stuff about punk specifically in there, but it's true though that it is about punk in the sense that punk is sort of the genre of rock and roll that most explicitly relies on these these aspects, these qualities of what makes for rock and roll. If you got to have beautiful harmonies, that's something else. You know, if you're like doing doo-wop girl group harmonies or something like that, it's less so, because that does take a certain, just take more skill.
Yeah.
But that puts it a little bit further from pure rock and roll. And punk is closer to pure rock and roll for the reasons that I'm talking about.
You know, in the book, it's really exciting. Some of my favorite parts are when you tell us about just how clear of a vision you had. I mean, you knew exactly what you wanted to do. It seems like when you were ready to pick up the instruments, and you had, you know, such a vision. It was very clear, and it seemed like obviously something that other people recognized as well. As we learn in Please Kill Me, the Richard Hell clones that show up, that start showing up at CBGBs. But then with someone like Malcolm McLaren, who came to New York managing the New York Dolls and sees you and just gets your vision as well and goes back to England and prints four, as Chris Stein says, and starts the Sex Pistols. Were you aware at the time of not only how clear your vision was for yourself, but for other people? Like him?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who didn't respond to what I was doing at all. I mean, in another way, too, it was a little bit frustrating when they did, because it would tend to be that, like, kind of... imitating what I was doing or something, or doing some kind of like taking it as a fashion rather than taking the underlying idea, which was find in yourself what is interesting to you, you know, like who you are and what you want to express, and then have everything about you contribute to communicating that. So for me, I'd come up with these things like torn clothes and a haircut and stuff like that, that I felt like were an expression of what was going on inside me. And that was more the message, was the fun thing to do is to, find a way to make, you know, in music, and in the whole package of having a band, you know, find ways to turn yourself inside out that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't really, there was less, you know, in retrospect, it all is obvious and inevitable, you know. I mean, stuff always works on that level of superficial style that people copy.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the other thing of the underlying process, you know. But
I guess then, though, back then, were you aware that, like, that you have the sense that people could not only copy or imitate, but turn it into a big business? Or was it just when you saw the Sex Pistols, you're like, ah, okay, of course. I mean, did you have a
sense?
Well,
I didn't read them as a big business. They were just a band.
Phenomenon,
right? It was a picture in a magazine where there were these four guys who all had my style. And it was just, like, funny. And it was,
yeah.
And, you know, and I saw Malcolm's name and
you sussed it
out.
Yeah,
it was like, but, you know, then it ended up being much more than I'd ever, you know, could have imagined from just that moment where, oh, look, here's somebody copying you in Europe.
Yeah.
You know,
you talk about this moment when you talk about how that you were demoralized a bit, but you definitely did not want to fall into the role of being the person who had influenced, you know, someone else. And it seems today like people are just tripping over each other to claim any shred of credit, you know, if something else, you know, takes their style or connects to something they did. But it seemed like you really knew, you had a sense even then that was it. Yeah, you really didn't want to do that. Why? What dangers did you see in sort of falling into that role?
Well, because I had more self-respect than that, you know. I mean, if that was, you know, and I even felt that way about the haircut. You know, there was a period, you know, for I don't know how many years in the 90s or something, where whenever my name came up in the media, it would basically be that I was the originator of torn clothes and chopped up hair. And if that's, you know, my claim to fame, I don't want to be famous.
Yeah. You do have one line, though. It's that I'm so bored with the USA from The Clash. You seem to say, like, all right, this is pushing it, you know, considering that the connections between The Clash and the Ramones and everything that was being taken from New York. To be on tour and having them sing this song seems a bit much.
Well, you know, there's a few ways in which, I mean, all those guys' pretenses to honesty are really ludicrous. I mean, they're funny, they're amusing, they're like they've done various inspiring things, but they're not honest. The Sex Pistols are not honest. I mean, John Lydon is not honest. Everything he says is basically some deceptive spin on glorifying himself.
Yeah, and the Clash, who you toured with, did you talk about their the political aspect of their music, which was different.
I'm not really, I don't have much, you know, knowledge or interest in the Clash.
Yeah. So let's come back to New York then. Setting the record straight, though, there is the most powerful and, you know, probably maybe the primary instance of that is, of course, dealing with the song Blank Generation and Lester Bangs' interpretation, which leads to decades of what you say are absolute misinterpretations of the song.
No, I don't say that. I don't say it's absolute misinterpretation. I just say to make it be the entire message is wrong.
Okay.
It exists, that concept that, you know, which Lester sort of extracted from me. That
misinterpretation. That I'm sorry for calling it absolute misinterpretation, but it is a misinterpretation.
It's an inadequate interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, can you talk about that story and what you want to tell us about that song today?
Well, the thing you're referring to is the. Syndrome, like the phenomenon that every time somebody brings up that song, they have to, you know, in journalism, they have to insert we're talking about my song Blank Generation, I have to insert this line about how the author of the song always makes the point that it's not a song about apathy and nihilism and numbness. It's about the possibility of filling in the blank and making yourself up and inventing yourself. I belong to the blank. I belong to the, you know, fill in the blank generation is about you're being able to write whatever you want in that blank so that you're creating who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and it just has always struck me as really funny and ironic that, I mean, basically to me, you know, because there was one interview in an obscure place where I brought up that aspect of the song. When obviously the song is about numbness and nihilism and apathy and emptiness. But it also has this other little aspect. But that's the little aspect that journalists always have to insist is what I actually meant, which to me, it the thing that's funny about it and revealing is that if that is the thing that people insist on hanging on to, it's because they're afraid of the idea of apathy and numbness and, and nihilism.
Nietzschean overcoming.
Yeah, so they have to like turn it into like, you know, bring it back up to the like, middle class, and have it be like all affirmation and self help and the joy of self realization. You know.
Yeah. And you're smiling,
which is complete distortion.
Sure, and you're smiling now, talking about getting to talk about this. But at the time when this sort of inadequate interpretation persisted and came up again and again, did that make you angry?
I just thought it was silly and revealing, as I said, you know. And it was also another example of how lazy and incompetent journalists are. Because the reason it gets, and half the reason it gets perpetuated like that, is that when a writer who's mentioning the song goes and Googles it, they'll find somebody else saying that.
Yeah.
And the way it's always phrased is that I, Richard, insist that I really meant this.
Yeah.
So they'll take that at face value and repeat it.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, journalists are that half-assed.
Yeah. You know, but now when you Google it, you'd probably also get a link talking about the connection to the Rod McEwen song, Beat Generation.
What about it?
Which is much more interesting. I'm really curious, like for you, especially when you wrote those lyrics, what kind of thoughts there were because again, like there's a different. This is the Blank Generation. There's the Beat Generation. Like, what did you like that song, or did you think, oh man?
No, it was just like this hilarious, stupid novelty song, but by, a pop, pseudo poet, you know, who was being really, sarcastic and kind of disgustingly superior to the Beat Generation by writing this song as if it were by a beatnik. And so there, it was just like an in-joke, to take that skeleton of an idea and turn it into something else.
Yeah. I mean, I heard that song probably like 10 years after, or at least, a long time after I, grew up listening to Blank Generation. So there was a kind of an exciting way of connecting those two, but it seems today, like if you Googled that, those two are just like linked together, hard. That perhaps isn't, as you're saying, that really important. You know, the links between your song and that song are not the point either.
Well, I think it's misread. It in a way, it's kind of what Richard Prince does. It's like an appropriation that you then paint over you at the same time, you know? It's like taking a picture of a nurse from a cheap soft porn series about sexy nurses and then slathering paint over it and turning it into something else.
Yeah. So let's move on. You have a passage that you said you could read.
If you want me to.
Oh, I'd love that.
The book also gets treated as kind of an indiscreet catalog of women with whom I had, relationships, like romantic to whatever degree, in those days, and there is a lot of references to whoever my girlfriend was at the moment that I'm describing. But that was important to me.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk specifically it's very classy. I mean, these industries.
Well, I don't know about that. But, I'll read a something that falls into that category. The women at CBGB were interesting, too. There were intellectual high school girls and band-happy go-go dancers, pretty photographers, girl journalists, and slumming rich nightclubbing types, not to mention women band members. The topless dancers probably predominated, at least in my consciousness, but the categories overlapped. Some of the topless dancers were also intellectual teenagers who wrote about bands and came from uptown, which pretty well describes Kathy Acker, come to think of it. Most just liked to get high and spend their nights with young musicians. I liked almost all of them. Being a rock and roll musician was like being a pimp. It was about making young girls want to pay money to be near you. That was the relationship with the anonymous audience and the audience you actually met as well. I was always ready to fall in love, but I had noticed that love comes in spurts, and that was appreciated by the women. Many of them expected or even required that their boyfriends neglect them a little. It proved how important the boyfriends were. Of course, most of the dancers came from unhappy family backgrounds. Relationships were expected to include abuse. The go-go dancers made a lot more money than the band members did, and they shared it freely. One of the most powerful mental images I retained from those days involves a girlfriend from a few months later in 1975, after I had left television and had started in with the Heartbreakers. Her name was Carol, and she was a 19-year-old topless dancer from rural Pennsylvania. She had long, straight, natural blonde hair and the face of a confused cheerleader. Her body was like a compilation of American male fantasies, so youthfully ripe that while having no excess, it seemed to be straining to burst from itself, with breasts that lifted as if they were scenting the air, an athlete's high butt that sheltered under it that little concave-sided triangle of light between the tops of her thighs, behind the soft, lush, see-through blonde pubic hair. And she was uncomplicated and good-natured and desirous to please. I was doing junk pretty often by then, but it still felt deluxe. I was sure that the drug was outlawed because the arrogant rich wanted it to themselves. Sticking a needle in my arm felt adult, like I was really in charge of myself finally, running my own destiny out from under. It was more independent than any other choice I'd ever made. Carol often had to work at night dancing in Midtown, so she wasn't always able to catch second sets at the club. She gave me the keys to her apartment, and after I was paid for a gig, maybe $50 and a good night, I'd likely go cop a couple of bags of dope and then let myself into her place to wait until she got off work at 2 or 3 a.m. One of those late nights, I was lying alone in semi-darkness in her big bed in that continuous, soft, slow-mo rippling of dope bliss, dreaming and drifting, when she let herself in. The trebly crunch of the key in the door distracted me out of my nod. She saw me and broke into smiles and jumped up in her miniskirt and tight blouse onto the bed, bright-eyed, straddling my torso, standing center panel of creased 3D panties directly above my eyes, and reached into her pockets and purses to lift out fistfuls and fistfuls of soft, crinkled money she released to float down all over me.
Yeah, that's a great, great passage. Yeah, it's classy. I have to say that's classy. Many of the women, you talk about them in ways that acknowledge, you know, how much they helped you. You know, the line about the pimp there, you know, is dark as the word pimp might be. There are many women who help you financially early on, and you talk about some of these girlfriends that they certainly didn't put you on your path, but they kept you. I mean, they helped you stay on it, it seems. Is that fair to say?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, was it difficult, though? Were there some relationships that you're like, oh, man, I just can't. I'm not putting that in the book.
I didn't deliberately leave anything out for a reason like that. Though, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things, not a lot, but something pops up every couple of weeks since the book was published or, you know, since I finished the final edit or whatever, that it occurs to me, I left out.
Yeah.
You know, like there was a whole, and people I didn't mention that, you know, did have some impact. But there was a whole trip to New Orleans for like 6 or 8 weeks where I was recording. And, you know, towards the end of the period, the book covers that I just completely forgot about, you know. I mean, once or twice it would come to mind in the process of writing the book, but it never happened at a moment when it was, you know, where I was actually at work, and it's one of those things that just never got handled. And, you know, the same goes for some relationships I had.
Yeah. I want to end with this idea of running away, which is tied to the title of the book, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. That comes from one of your earliest adventures of running away that you wrote as a kid. And you talk about having this impulse that stays with you to now, and yet, you know, for someone who's lived in the same place and who's lived in the same city for so long, it might, you know, you could read, Richard is happy. He's found where he needed to be. That's absolutely not the case. You seem to tell us there are... I'd like to hear about how that stays with you and how you find other ways to satisfy that impulse.
I'm sorry. I got distracted in my mind while you were talking. You repeat what you were asking me.
I just wanted to come back to the idea of running away, which is where we get this title of you as a young boy.
Uh-huh.
You know, you go on an adventure where you run away. And it seems that you could say, Richard comes to New York, stays here, almost in the same apartment. He doesn't need to run away anymore. He's home. Whereas that's, you make it clear to us in the book that you discover other ways of, or satisfying that impulse, or the...
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a kind of, basically, the purest running away is to actually do that, run away. Leave everything about yourself behind and go begin again somewhere where you're not known and where you don't know the environment. The classic idea of running away.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other ways of doing that. In your consciousness, without that classic physical total, what do you call it? When transplanting of yourself, mm-hmm. It all just sounds so diluted, but it's really true that if you, like as an artist, if you try to do something in a new medium that you don't know. In fact, you know, I have this fantasy that I'm going to become a painter when I lose my mental faculties. assuming I can still see.
Uh-huh.
Once I become senile and can't put words together anymore,
yeah,
I'll start painting. But, you know, really, I mean, that's part of what was fun about becoming a musician. I mean, that was a real, that was a major, yeah, for me, instance of that, you know, the essence of running away, even though it's not, you know, putting all my possessions in a handkerchief, yeah, and getting on a cargo boat to Africa or something.
Yeah.
It still was entering an area where I knew nothing and nobody knew me, and making everything up from scratch.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's still, I mean, to me, that's my method. That's what I like doing,
yeah,
as a way to keep life interesting.
And what are some of the ways that satisfies that impulse today here in New York, in a city that seems harder and harder to do that or even have fun in?
Well, get married.
Oh, man, this was fun. All right, I'm sorry if I picked the wrong word sometimes, you know, but I did my best.
You did great. I have no complaints.
So thank you so much, Richard, for coming on the show and this.
You can find a longer version of Benjamin's interview with Richard Hell at the TMI podcast page. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, I'm going to be joined by guest DJ Bill Mullen, who will be presenting Philip Random's top 1,111 songs of all time. Yes, today on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show, Bill Mullen's gonna bring that giant list, and we're gonna hear a few excerpts. Right now, we're gonna start with Negative Land on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU.
This announcement from the producers of this record contains important information for radio program directors and is not for broadcast. The first cut on this record has been cross-format focused for airplay success. As you well know, a record must break on radio in order to actually provide a living for the artists involved. Up until now, you've had to make these record-breaking decisions on your own, relying only on perplexing intangibilities like taste and intuition. But now, there's a better way. The cut that follows is the product of newly developed compositional techniques based on state-of-the-art marketing analysis technology. This cut has been analytically designed to break on radio. And it will. Sooner or later. For the station that breaks it first, the benefits are obvious. You lead the pack. Yes, no matter what share of this crazy market you do business in, no other release is going to satisfy your corporation's current idea of good radio like this one. On this cut, we're working together on the same wavelength in scientific harmony. But remember, this cut is constructed for multi-market breaking now. Don't waste valuable research with needless delay. We've done the hard work of ensuring your success. The final step is up to you. Special designer song follows in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
eastern world. It is exploding, violence flaring, and bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, so what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating, and you tell me. You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, that you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. The whole human race is a far-out situation. We're supposed to be brothers, but still there's segregation. You can go to the moon, spend 2 weeks in space, but when you come home, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next-door neighbor, but don't forget to see race. Of destruction.
Who are you?
My name is Bill Mullen. I usually don't say it on air, but since you ask.
Bill, welcome to the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show. Please explain what you're going to be doing here today. You're interpreting the life's work of a guy called Philip Random. Now, people that listen to CITR radio in Vancouver may have heard you for how long? How long have you been interpreting the life of Philip Random on the airwaves of CITR in Vancouver?
Most recently, starting in November of 2011, November 5th, which was the anniversary of the gunpowder plot, for those who know their English history, we started counting down the 1,111 greatest records you probably have not heard, as chosen by Philip Random.
So basically, today on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show, the 1,111 greatest records you probably haven't heard, a.k.a. selections from the collection of Philip Random, as curated by Bill Mullen, the host of Randophonic. So, Bill, can you tell us a bit about this Philip Random? We're hearing some of his records here today. Actually, before we get deep into Philip Random, what did we just hear, and what would have Philip said about what we just heard?
Those were two selections from the list. Most recently, we heard actually the lowest song on the list, the 1,111th greatest record most people probably haven't already heard. That was Paul Revere and the Raiders doing Indian Reservation. Do you want me to read what Philip had to say about it?
Please, go ahead.
It's a 1971 single, I think. Why start here? Because it's one of those eternal truths. The fan is being hit by always has, always will. Even the Jordan River has bodies floating. Paul Revere and company's sort of Vegas schmaltz edge really sets Barry Maguire's 1965 Fire and Brimstone mega hit Free here, which means disregard the release date of 1971. This gem didn't collide with my worldview until at least 1992. The grunge revolution was already tired. We were drinking stronger, more complicated cocktails. Folks were no longer denying the irony in pretty much everything. That is, if you told us then that less than a decade later we'd be celebrating some secret history of not just rock and roll, but every damn thing of cultural import over the past 4 or 5 decades, and this record would be key in that telling, well, we'd probably believe you. And a few minutes later, somebody'd be puking their guts out.
And before that, we heard Some Negative Land.
Yeah, that's from their 1987 really great album called Escape from Noise, and that's the opening track called Announcement, about which Mr. Random notes, so what if it's not a song? It's definitely a record, a recording, lead-off track from 1987's Escape from Noise, which is rather appropriate. 1987 definitely being a year where music didn't suck so much as noise suddenly felt very relevant, and nobody...